She said nonchalantly, "You know, when he was asked which of Chairman Mao's policies might still be relevant in China, Hu Yaobang said, 'I think none.'"
"You know better than to repeat such things."
"If the General Secretary can say it, why can't I?"
Her father straightened. "Since when did you become the General Secretary? And wasn't he purged?"
On the radio, Red Guards were shouting ridiculous slogans at a disgraced Hu Yaobang. This was the 1960s, before Ai Ming was born, and the frenzied sound clip lasted only a few seconds before moving on to better days. Here he was in the new economic zones. Here he was with cadres in the Northwest. After the Cultural Revolution and the downfall of the Gang of Four, Comrade Hu worked for the rehabilitation of those who had been wrongly accused. He traveled through 1,500 districts and villages, all the way to remote Xinjiang and Inner Mongolia, to see how party policies manifested in people's lives. It rained harder. Ai Ming slowly peeled an orange. In the alleyway, Yiwen walked by, wearing a new pink dress. It swayed against her hips as she went, floating against her long, pale legs. Ai Ming felt as vulnerable as this naked orange in her hand. They were the same age, but she was a child compared to Yiwen, who was an actual university student. Yiwen had a portable cassette player, and she was always listening to music as she walked. It was very modern and deeply Western to listen to music that no one else could hear. Private music led to private thoughts. Private thoughts led to private desires, to private fulfillments or private hungers, to a whole private universe away from parents, family, and society. The squeak of Sparrow's plastic slippers interrupted her thoughts. Ai Ming gave him the peeled orange, and he smiled, as if she had given him the sun. He went to the record player, and Ai Ming flicked off the radio, silencing Hu Yaobang in mid-sentence. She crawled into bed, even though it was still early. The fugue of Bach's musical offering circled in the darkness like a dog chasing its tail. Ai Ming heard her mother come home, and the routine words her parents exchanged. Same bed, different dreams. The old saying described Sparrow and Ling perfectly. How could it be that her mother was such an independent, modern creature? Why did her father love someone so far away from his present reality? How could Ai Ming live a better life than theirs? To her, the only essay question that mattered was how was it possible for a person to write her own future? On Monday, Ai Ming ran into the neighbor Yiwen at the water spigot.
"You're going to Tiananmen Square this morning, aren't you?"
the older girl asked. Taken aback, Ai Ming could only say, "Why?" The girl laughed. She lifted her full water bucket, staggering backwards.
"Yes, why?"
Yiwen said, still laughing.
"I almost believed you. Ai Ming, you really tricked me. What a straight face. If I ever need someone to give an alibi for me, I'm coming to you first."
Ai Ming smiled. She watched Yiwen's pink dress float down the alley. Back in her room, she stood for a moment, looking at the stack of books on the desk. The university examinations were still 3 months away. She drew the curtain across the window, changed her dress, and left the apartment. She pedaled slowly, in love with the wind against her face. Long before Jianguomen changed into Chang'an Avenue, she saw bits of flowers, paper, and ribbon all over the road, accumulating like clouds, until, at the square, she arrived at an unreal scene. Thousands of funeral wreaths
with their paper ribbons, were pulsating in the breeze. Just off the avenue, factory workers were having a public meeting. Some girls were reciting poetry, and a group of university students huddled on the ground with ink brushes and paper, writing essay-length posters. She walked deeper into the square, searching ludicrously for Yiwen. The concrete seemed to expand from her own feet, like an endless gray footprint. At the moment to the people's heroes, three grandmothers were muttering subversely.
Heart attack. Just like that, right in the middle of the Politburo meeting. Those foxes humiliated him. They bullied him until his heart gave out.
A colossal black-and-white Hu Yaobang towered over them. The photo blown up so big that Comrade Hu's nose was the height of a man. Posters were everywhere, on the ground, affixed to the monument, on makeshift boards. The ones who should drop dead still live. The one who should live has died. Just reading the poster made Ai Ming feel as if she had cursed the government or ratted out her father. She actually lifted a hand to cover her eyes. Still the words on the posters slipped between her fingers. Why is it that we can't choose our own jobs? What right does the government have to keep a private file on me? She turned around, only to find herself facing another wall of paper. Is it not time to live like human beings? Do you remember? I am lonely. She stepped closer, squinting at the characters. Do you remember? What illegal thoughts. The ones who should die. But actually, why should anyone's thoughts be illegal? In the distance, the concrete was shifting. It metamorphosed into a small crowd. The small crowd seemed to replicate itself. More and more demonstrators appeared, with banners elongated like ships above their heads. Arise, slaves, arise! We shall take back the fruits of our labor. A Tsinghua University flag dipped and slid sideways. And there were others, too, flags announcing the Institute of Aeronautics and People's University. The students met a line of police. From far away, it looked like a gray wave gulping up a string of fish. The police disappeared, and the crowd grew fatter. A banner floated, delicate as a finger, towards her. Long live education! She couldn't help but wonder how the first years among them had answered the examination question, Leo Tolstoy, discuss. Turning awkwardly, she tripped over a school bag. The owner apologized and kicked the bag carelessly away from them. She thought she heard something snap. When she smiled, the shadows under his eyes widened. The boy asked what department she was in, and, when Ai Ming stared, he pointed to a pendant above his head. Education department. And then, answering a question she hadn't asked, he said, an official reevaluation of Hu Yaobang's life and career. An end to the political pollution campaign. That's number one and two. And also, we're asking the government to free those arrested in 1977 for speaking the truth. The heroes of Democracy Wall, you know. 12 years later, and they're still in prison. It turned out he was speaking to someone behind her. Humiliated, she stepped sideways and out of his line of vision. His glasses had no nose rests, and the frames were sliding down. She wanted tenderly to push them up. The students started shouting, Yao Bang forever! The sweetness of a piece of cake she had eaten earlier in the day persisted in her mouth. Bits of paper carnations were stuck to her shoes, and Ai Ming tried to scrub them off against the gray concrete, not wanting to trail them like evidence back home. She found her bicycle and pedaled slowly back, against the constant stream of Beijingers moving towards the square. That evening, she crouched with Yi Wen in the courtyard, and they washed dishes together.
"Okay, tell me," Yi Wen whispered. "What exactly is revolution?"
Ai Ming coughed softly and said, "What?"
"Okay, okay," Yi Wen said. "Just joking. I thought I would help you study, but seriously, don't you think citizens should own themselves? Be their own people? Isn't a self only a body combined with a system of thought?"
"A self?" A plastic dish slid out of Yi Wen's soapy fingers and spluttered back into the water. She was wearing sneakers, a white t-shirt that served as a dress, and a pink bandana. She'd recently gotten a violently short haircut. Ai Ming had noticed that she carried a spray bottle and every now and then would squirt a big cloud of homemade insect repellent at her bare legs. When she got bitten, she roughly slapped her calves and thighs as if they belonged to someone else.
"My beta boyfriend,"
Yi Wen said, as if she had other boyfriends at other universities,
"says that thousands of wallpapers calling for reform have gone up in the last 24 hours. His best friend carried a banner to the square last night. You know what it said? It said, 'The soul of China.'"
She sighed and scrubbed her family's rice pot.
"The job assignments are pitiful these days. Who knows where they'll unload us once we graduate? I have a cousin who works alone in a closed-down factory in Shanxi province, completely alone. She's supposed to be an accountant. What kind of job is that?"
"If you study at a Beijing university, you end up with a good job, don't you?"
"Beijing?" Yi Wen made a face. "We should all go to the West. America owns the past, and they own the future, too. What do we own?"
She slapped the water.
"Hey, what kind of rock music do you like?"
Her t-shirt dress had soaked over her thighs, and soap bubbles slid down her knee.
"Are there different kinds?"
Yi Wen giggled.
"Like Northwest Wind style. Do you like that? Let's sing something. You know anything by White Angel or Mayday?"
All afternoon, Ai Ming had been reading Let the Natural Sciences Contend, and her head was full of geological disturbances.
"I'm not good at remembering lyrics." "Ai Ming, little country girl, my father told me that your father used to be a musician. Is that true? Like a rock musician? Hey, come on, you're not really this shy, are you?"
This was worse than the national examinations. Ai Ming had no idea what the correct answer could be. Fortunately, it didn't matter, because Yi Wen had her own monologue going. Now she started singing by herself. "I've never stopped asking you, when will you come with me? But you always laugh at me because I have nothing. I am giving you my aspirations and my freedom, too." One of the neighbors, a little boy known as Watermelon, started singing along. He was small, but he had a big, wet voice. "I want to grab your hands. Come with me." Yi Wen stood up, the little dress too small for anything.
"Want to come to the square, Ai Ming?"
"I can't."
"Tomorrow, then."
Yi Wen tipped over the bucket of soapy water, dumping it out, and then put the clean dishes inside.
"What's your boyfriend like?"
Ai Ming asked. Yi Wen got to her feet, swaying slowly, the dishes clattering like rattled birds. She smiled teasingly.
"I like it when you leave your hair down."
Ai Ming plunged her hands into her own dishwater and said,
"Yi Wen, where did you get your cassette player?"
"From Fat Lips on the corner. You want one?"
He always gives me a really good price.
I want one. For my father.
Sure, anytime. Knock on my window. We'll go together. We're not Red Guards. We're the surviving remnants of the May 4th generation. Can't you tell the difference?
Ai Ming's alarm clock hadn't sounded yet. It must be early. Or maybe it was late. The middle of the night. But Yi Wen's voice was instantly recognizable.
Queen Mother of the West, we put aside every dream for you, and look what a terror you've become.
Ai Ming sat up in bed. Yi Wen's father sounded exhausted. His voice seemed to split into three parts as he shouted louder.
Protesting the government at Zhongnanhai in the middle of the night, getting arrested. You're not really my daughter, are you?
Yi Wen's mother kept repeating the same words over and over.
Calling the leaders by their first names! So what if I call Li Ping by his name? They're just people!
Yi Wen shouted.
People have names! Why can't you see that? You had the revolution to believe in, but what do we have?
A door slammed. Someone, it must be Yi Wen, was crying. But perhaps it was Yi Wen's father. Ai Ming sat up. Nobody talked like that, so the whole interlude must have been a dream. Patiently, she waited to come to her senses. Shadows fell in waves across the bedclothes, and nothing in the room seemed still. She hugged the sheet and remembered Yi Wen's pink dress, which expanded, covering her. Smelling of jasmine, even as the argument went on fitfully, only partially overheard, lulling her back to sleep. If you can solve a physics problem, you can solve this. The bird of quiet was looking over her shoulder, later that morning, examining the study questions on Ai Ming's desk. All you have to do in this essay question is demonstrate correct political understanding. I think you should do a more careful study of Mao Zedong Marxist-Leninist thought, especially this chapter, A Methodology, and Matter of Materialism as Objective Reality. Two cantaloupe seeds had stuck to his hand, and she noticed two on her left hand as well. These four seeds blocked out everything Sparrow was saying. After her father had closed the door again, she returned to staring out the window. Of course, the people outside, the neighborhood aunties, Yi Wen, and Watermelon, could see her as well as she could see them. They were taking down the laundry before the rain resumed, and no one paid any attention to her sitting miserably between her stacks of books. Yi Wen's eyes were puffy. She was singing mournfully to herself. I grew up beneath the red flag. I took the oath to dare to think, to speak up, to act, to devote myself to revolution. The air had the icy kiss of winter, which was perfect, really, for a funeral. Hu Yaobang would have approved. A week had passed since the announcement of his death, and today, a Saturday, the whole city was going to Chang'an Avenue to pay their respects. Sparrow, however, said they weren't going. Tiananmen Square had been barricaded off, so they would watch it on the neighborhood television. Television was better, he said. Her father had allowed one of his co-workers to give him a haircut. She didn't know how much baijiu the comrade had drunk, but it all looked a little lopsided. She found it difficult to argue with him. That bad haircut evoked too much pity. Meanwhile, Ma unexpectedly announced she was going to the funeral procession because it was the correct thing to do.
You can come with me, Ai Ming, if you like.
To go or not to go. In the end, the bad haircut won.
It's okay. I'll keep Ba company.
If Ling was hurt, she didn't show it. She put on her good shoes and walked elegantly out. Her mother was unfailingly elegant, as if she were a stranger in her own house, which she was. Ai Ming hadn't lived with her since she was 3 years old, and even though it wasn't Ling's fault, she still felt as if Ling was only impersonating a mother. Ai Ming had always felt more at ease with her great-aunt, the old cat, a rare books collector who ran a mobile library. She drove it around in the back of a vegetable truck. The old cat lived by herself in Shanghai.
I'm a single modern woman,
and was almost 70 years old. The funeral was due to start at 10 a.m., so Ai Ming and Sparrow had a slow breakfast. He read the newspaper, and she alternated between collected letters of Tchaikovsky and Sun Tzu's The Art of War. And the only sound was the crackling of the pages, and her father grunting softly in response to an article, or maybe just an advertisement. Radio Beijing was announcing things that everyone already knew, and then repeating them again. For security, Tiananmen Square had been closed to the public. People would have to gather on the surrounding boulevards, etc., etc. Ai Ming realized she was looking forward to the few seconds of silence during the funeral, because finally, the radio would have to stop lecturing. Sparrow poured her a glass of pear juice.
It's strange that the government would close the square. I suppose Comrade Hu Yaobang was very popular.
Oh, poor Hu, she thought. She had seen pictures of Hu Yaobang all her life. His perfectly egg-shaped head, the man who thought he could change China from within, introduce economic freedom step by step, serve prosperity one sip at a time. Ai Ming wondered, could such a method ever work? Was there anyone in this world who could taste something delicious, economic freedom and political reform, a taste that was salty and fattening and sweet and promising, and only be satisfied with one mouthful? Who could wait patiently for nearly a billion other people to also have a taste? No, anyone would try to get a second mouthful, a third, a whole bowl for themselves. Of course, Hu Yaobang had failed, and of course, he had been purged. Her thoughts disturbed her. All sorts of private thoughts had been opened up by the sight of Yi Wen's pink dress. Even in these modern times, few people wore pink, and Ai Ming supposed Yi Wen had dyed the dress herself. What about that boy, with the glasses slipping down his nose? She had wanted to reach out and touch his slender waist and ask him... Ask him what? Doesn't it all seem absurd to you? Why do we have no words for what we truly feel? What's wrong with our parents? She went into her bedroom and, because it was cold, dressed under the covers, her left foot and then her right, struggling to find their way through her jeans. She lay in bed with just her jeans on and no other clothes, her hand moving between the bare skin of her stomach and the thickness of the denim. She imagined that all the world existed between these two sensations, nakedness and clothing, softness and roughness, within and without. What would it be like to leave the country entirely? Here, a change in party policy could abruptly exile you to the deserts. She pulled on a shirt and then a sweater. Her bare skin felt as if it were waiting for something that would never happen. Nothing fit properly. She would have to alter all her clothes and recut everything differently. I want to live, she thought. But nobody here knows how. Her father suddenly announced he, too, wanted to go to Tiananmen Square to pay his respects to Hu Yaobang, that it was better to go now, because the streets would no longer be crowded. It was as if he had just woken up and realized who had died.
Okay, Ai Ming said. I'll come with you.
The bird of quiet sat down at once to fold two paper carnations. When he was done, he pinned the first carefully to Aiming's coat, and the second to his own. They put on their shoes, untangled their bicycles, and pedaled slowly out of the alleyway. How lanky her father was! Maybe it was unavoidable that a man who did wiring all his life would start to look like a wire himself. The streets outside were not crowded. A few teenagers were sitting on a flower pot at the Muxidi Bridge. None as attractive as Yiwen, whose skin was as pale and fragrant as the flesh of a pear. Aiming rode up alongside Sparrow, who began humming Beethoven's Fifth as if to amuse her. "Ba, let me fix your haircut." He smiled, coasting.
"Old B told me this haircut would make me look young."
"It's a bit crooked, that's all."
All warfare is based on deception, she thought, and depends on the element of surprise.
Anyway, what if I apply to universities in Canada?
She noticed no alteration in his pace, only a slight tipping of his bicycle towards the sidewalk, which he immediately corrected. She pressed on.
Ewan said that almost everyone she knows at Beijing Normal has sent out applications to America. Canada is less expensive, though. Imagine if I want a scholarship. You could come with me, because I wouldn't want to go alone.
Her recklessness seemed to come from the streets themselves. This is what happens when politicians die all of a sudden, she thought. It's like a table leg collapsing, and things go sliding off.
Everyone says it's very cold in Canada,
Sparrow said. He sped forward.
And isn't your worst subject English?
Your daughter can be good at anything if only she applies herself.
Sparrow had no ready answer for that. Fortunately for him, the road suddenly got crowded. He detoured south into the smaller alleyways inside the second ring road. Turning a corner, he nearly collided with a line of city workers sweeping the street. But they kept on working, as if he had never existed and never would. Some of them looked 50 years older than Big Mother Knife.
"Aiming," he said, when she caught up to him again. "First it was Beijing, and now it's Canada. Once we get to Canada, maybe it will be the moon."
"Others have done it. Even the moon."
"I used to imagine I would go to the West, too, and that I would bring my family with me."
She waited for him to continue, but her father's thought remained a half-thought. The street was bottling up, but still he pedaled headlong into the mourners, pushing between people like a dumpling between noodles. The sky was so white, as if all colors had been sheared away. There were paper flowers in the trees and on the ground, on the coats of everyone around them, and the air smelled not of dust, but of a rich and mouth-watering broth. Along the road, families were sitting down to lunch. Faced with this immovable congestion, Sparrow finally dismounted, and they began walking conspicuously against the flow of the crowd. She and her father were completely out of tune with the moment. Aiming walked with her head down. The gray propriety of Beijing, the ochre goodness of it, belonged to people who knew when to arrive for funerals and what time to eat lunch. She became aware of a new crowd approaching. They were chanting, and at first she couldn't make out the words. The loudspeaker they used was weak and tinny. Eventually she saw two young men, each wearing a red armband, carrying a banner that read, "We are young. Our country needs us." The two were unusually tall, and their banner swayed high into the air. Behind them, the students were sweating. Their formal clothes had come untucked,
Some looked like they had been fighting, and they were crying. Their devotion to Hu Yaobang was sincere, Ai Ming thought suddenly, while hers had always been impersonal. Do we love our country? Yes. Are we willing to sacrifice our future for the Chinese people? Yes. Did we do anything wrong? Sobbing. No. No. They were passing now, linked to one another, like paper dolls. The lunching families looked up from their tables. Some got to their feet. Sparrow, too, had stopped walking and was staring at the student procession. What's happened? What's happened? The words rebounded from person to person. A boy disengaged himself from the long line and was immediately surrounded. He said that student representatives from the universities had tried to present a petition to the government. Three young men had knelt on the steps of the Great Hall of the People and had remained on their knees for 45 minutes, while all around them the students and Beijing citizens had yelled at them to stand up, to stop kneeling. Yet they had remained, holding the petition up in the air as if they were children before their father, or slaves before an emperor. But no representative from the government had come out. Lines of police, 20 men deep, had stood between the crowd and the great hall. Last night, 100,000 university students had walked to Tiananmen Square and slept there overnight, so that when the square was closed off in the morning, they would already be inside. We only wanted to pay our respects to Hu Yaobang, just as those before us have always paid their respects in times of mourning. Even the police had called for the students to stand up. They asked us why we had to address the government on our knees, but nobody could answer. Officials had stared at them from inside the glass doors, and only one, a professor from Beida, had finally come out and tried to pull the young men up.
But there was no violence, the boy said. There was no violence. The police agreed with us. Some of them were weeping, too. We're all brothers.
He looked stunned. He turned away and rejoined the procession, buckling himself back into the connected arms.
Boycott classes! We must have the courage to stand up!
A placard floated by. According to the Chinese Constitution, Article 35, the citizens have the right to free speech and assembly. Applause rippled down the avenue. Dust had gotten into Ai Ming's eyes. She tried to rub it out, but the rubbing only made it worse. The students looked crushed. Their paper flowers were flattened against their chests. In fact, she thought, they looked as if they had come from another country, even though they had only come from a few blocks away. In her distraction, the bicycle slipped from her hands and smacked hard against someone's knee. She dropped her head and began to apologize, expecting someone to call her an idiot country fool. But instead, the bicycle righted itself and floated back into her hands.
Good for you, students, a woman said.
Her voice was scratchy. She was rubbing her knee.
You're braver than we were. Much braver. When my generation gathered in Tiananmen Square, it was a different world.
Ai Ming looked up. But either the woman had melted away, or Ai Ming couldn't affix the voice to the face. All around her, older people were looking at her as if she had given them lucky money. She could not see properly. She felt as if the sidewalks, the tables and chairs, were all shifting, but she was frozen.
I'm sorry, she whispered.
Everything flowed before her. The crowd grew denser, and then it slowly loosened. It was not until they had nearly reached the square that she could feel her own weight again, her two legs, the solidity of the bicycle.
Sparrow, too, was quiet. He had lost his paper flower, and his coat looked naked. His bicycle creaked. She unfastened her own flower, pulled him to a stop, and pinned it to him. Behind him, the last remnants of the student procession turned right, north, towards the university district. What world had they come from, and to what world were they returning?
Aiming, what are you thinking?
What had the square looked like this morning when the sun rose on 100,000 youth curled together on the concrete? She felt embarrassed because, in response to her father's question, she, a young scholar, could only think of Ewan's favorite song. It's not that I don't understand, it's that things are changing so fast.
Sparrow rephrased. What are these students thinking?
They had entered the square now. The phalanxes of police remained, guarding the great hall of the people, even though it was probably empty. The day was quickly getting on. A conscientious few students were meticulously picking up garbage, but they left the paper flowers, which tumbled like pollen whenever a breeze came. The oversized Hu Yaobang gazed sorrowfully down from the monument.
I came here when I was a small child, Sparrow said. Big Mother brought me. She told me that the square is a microcosm of the human body, the head, the heart, the lungs. She told me not to get lost.
Did you get lost? Aiming asked.
Of course. The space is so large. It takes more than 1 million people to fill it. Even in 1966, the Red Guards couldn't do it.
Ba, Aiming said. I want to go abroad. There was some part of her that remained untapped, she thought, that would never come to life unless it was given space.
Person needs money to go abroad. Your mother and I don't have that kind of money.
The ones without money try to find outside sponsorship. Sparrow was quiet. The art of war, Aiming thought, ashamed. Be subtle. Be subtle. And use your spies for every kind of business. If you know someone in Canada who could sponsor me, I could go. Her father looked at her as if from a great distance. Had she been too direct? Was it obvious she had invaded his privacy? Ewan told me, she said hurriedly, baldly lying. She said she has an uncle in America. That's why she applied to go overseas. I thought we might know someone.
But why would I know anyone in Canada?
Ba said. His voice was piercingly gentle, cutting her like a toothpick. I don't know. You must know musicians who went away, she said wretchedly. With my grades, if I studied hard, I could...
Bei Da is the best university in the country. Your mother and I don't want you to study in Canada. It's so far away.
But you could come with me. Sparrow shook his head, but not in a way that said no. She said, Once, you told me that when you were young, you wanted to go abroad, to write your music, to hear other influences. Why is it too late? Ba, you've been working in the factory for 20 years. And this is a long time in a person's life. I have a sense that things are changing. The whole point of Hu Yaobang's reforms was to give opportunities to people like you, people who are unfairly treated.
Is that what you think, Aiming, that I was unfairly treated?
He touched the flower she had pinned to his coat, as if he had just noticed it. She wanted to curl up into a ball. Even though her intent was good, the directness of her words made her feel as if she was poking him repeatedly with a sharpened stick. After a moment, Sparrow said. And what about your mother?
Ma lived nearly 20 years away from us. What difference would it make to her?
She lived far away because the government assigns our jobs and our housing.
But why? Why can't we choose for ourselves? Across from them in the emptiness of the square, there were posters asking this very same question. She was not alone in her thinking. She had nothing to fear.
Ba doesn't even know how afraid he is, she thought.
His generation has gotten so used to it, they don't even know that fear is the primary emotion they feel.
I chose my life, Aiming, he said. I chose the life that I could live with. Maybe it doesn't seem that way from the outside.
She wondered if he believed his own words. She said, I know, Ba. They stood together in the square, where funeral wreaths softened the emptiness. The architecture was intended to make a person feel insignificant, but Aiming felt confusingly large. There was so much room here. A child could run in any pattern, make any shape, never encounter anyone or anything.
I want to know what it's like in a young country with lots of space, she said. If you say something out loud, you hear your own voice differently.
Sparrow nodded. She said,
Canada.
In Sparrow's mind, lines of Chairman Mao came back unbidden. We had much to do, and quickly. The sky earth spins, and time is short. 10,000 years is long, and so a morning and an evening count. Near to them, in front of the great hall of the people, the first line of police, too, seemed to be melting. It could be, Sparrow thought, that a person does not even know that they have gone quiet. Qi could be a substance that begins as a strength and transmutes imperceptibly into loss. They had reached the southern edge of the square. Now Aiming asked him,
Why did the students kneel down?
I imagine they wanted to show respect. They followed the ways in which petitioners have always approached the government.
But why did no government official come out?
Because, even though they were kneeling, if a member of the government had come and addressed their demands, the students would have been in a position of power.
The sun was luminous, but the wind was cold. His daughter hugged herself tightly. Paper flowers jumbled over the ground. Paper carnations grew from the trees, though some had fallen, and been mashed by the everlasting stream of bicycles. He heard their tinkling bells, and also a music in his head, shaken loose, the 12th Goldberg variation. Two voices engaged in a slightly out-of-breath canon, like a knot that never got tied. He could still write music. The thought jolted him. It might be possible to procure a piano. He could visit the Central Conservatory and ask for the use of a practice room. But then Sparrow had an image of himself waiting beneath their turning fans and smiled to think of himself appearing in this Beijing Wire Factory No. 3 uniform and his blue worker's cap. The absurdity of it made a deep impression. His age struck him forcefully, as if some blindfold had momentarily loosened and allowed him to see things as they were. He wanted to take Aiming's hand. Sometimes, when Aiming bruised her knee on the table or suffered some psychological melancholy, it seemed to lodge inside him as well. Where did the line between parent and child exist? He'd always tried to refrain from pushing her in one direction or the other, ever fearful he might drive her towards the party. But what if his silence had let her down or failed her in some crucial way? But maybe, he thought,
A parent should always have failings, some place into which a child can sink her teeth, because only then can a child come to know herself. He thought about those young students, kneeling with their petition. Eventually they would be arrested. It was inevitable. What happened to all that music, Ba? What if... I wish you'd been able to get away, to the West or some other place. I think, if it weren't for me, maybe you would have tried to live a more honest life. Had he been dishonest? Sparrow wondered. To whom had he been dishonest? Hadn't he said what needed to be said? Forgive me for speaking so directly, Ba. Only, you raised me to think my own thoughts, even if I couldn't say them aloud. Isn't that so? I think the time has come to say sincerely what I feel. The brutality of children never ceased to surprise him. He had to stop and rest. His heart was beating strangely, and his hands felt full of paper cuts, even though there was no visible injury. Aiming caught hold of his arm. She looked suddenly alarmed, and he wanted to smooth the terror from her face. Big Mother Knife and Aunt Swirl used to trace their fingers over his forehead, his eyebrows. When he was a child, it would help him fall asleep. But that was almost 50 years ago, when Shanghai was occupied. How funny, Sparrow thought, to think that he had been a child of a former world. When had he ceased to be that person? Aiming pulled him to a sidewalk bench, and then she ran to fill her tea thermos. She also came back with fish balls on a stick. They looked so unappealing, his mouth twisted in disgust. Relieved, Aiming laughed. He drank the tea, and she ate the fish balls, savoring their saltiness as only a young person can. He fought the urge to put his arm around her. Did he want to hold on to her, to keep her safe, he wondered, or just to keep himself from being lonely? Aiming was 18 years old, and she was ready to find a new beginning, entirely different from his own. This realization shocked him. Aiming was still so young, and already she had judged him. Over the weekend, the square came into Sparrow's thoughts, like a continuous sound. He had heard from his co-workers that hundreds of thousands of people continued to gather there. They were writing public messages, using Hu Yaobang's funeral as a pretext to mourn others, those who'd never been given a proper burial. On Tuesday, when Sparrow arrived home from work, Aiming and Ling were engrossed by the apricots they were eating and barely noticed him. He changed out of his factory clothes. The previous night, while his wife and daughter slept, he'd written a wall poster to bring to the square. Now he tucked the narrow roll of paper into his coat. By the time Sparrow reached Tiananmen Square, it was twilight. Thousands of others like him had come to feel the breeze of the open air. Walking across the square's infinite grayness, he felt as if he had been exiled to some distant moon. The memorial to Hu Yaobang remained. More flowers had arrived, and more posters. In 1976, after Premier Zhou Enlai died, similar events had taken place. Beijingers had come to the square and mourned openly, provocatively. His death had allowed people to demonstrate loyalty to the disappeared, to people like Zhu Li. The government must know that allegiance to the dead was a stubborn loyalty that no policy could eradicate. He took the poster from his coat. Nearby, two girls were mixing glue, and he asked for their assistance.
"No problem, Grandfather,"
one said. She had a Shanghai accent.
"I'll stick that up for you."
She read over his poster, nodded with a kind of bureaucratic approval, and pasted it up in a prominent position. Sparrow had copied a quote from the scholar Kang Youwei, whose treatises he had read in Kai's room, with the professor San Li, Ling, and the old cat, and still remembered. And yet throughout the world, past and present, for thousands of years, those whom we call good men, righteous men, have been accustomed to the sight of such things, have sat and looked and considered them to be matters of course, have not demanded justice for the victims or offered help to them. This is the most appalling, unjust, and unequal thing, the most inexplicable theory under heaven. The contours of Hu Yaobang's portrait were disappearing bit by bit. In the openness of the square, he allowed himself, for the first time in many years, to remember. Zhu Li was in room 103, playing Prokofiev. His symphony number 3 had been finished in his head 1,000 times, but he couldn't hear the ending. Perhaps the places in ourselves that appear empty have only been dormant, unreachable. Zhu Li, he thought, I'm sorry that I came too late. Of course he knew that she had forgiven him long ago. So why did he hold on to this guilt? What was the thing he was most afraid of? The next afternoon, Sparrow gazed once more into the chassis of the Model 3812 radio. At the next workstation, Old B and Miss Lu were arguing over the ongoing demonstrations, which had spread to a boycott of classes at 39 universities by 60,000 students. Despite the fact that university students were now banned from factory grounds, someone had managed to smuggle pamphlets into the cafeteria. 10 polite questions for the Chinese Communist Party. Beat's foot kept kicking the table leg to punctuate his words, which seemed to be directed at no one.
Donkeys, donkeys, donkeys.
Just last month, 50 people here got reprioritized, Miss Lu said placidly. They've no jobs and no rations. Modernization stinks.
But we need to be practical.
B made a triple kick.
We don't need 1 million kids in the square. We need a few smart bosses who know how to run the shop.
The young woman beside Sparrow shouted,
Fuck this wire! These new 1432s are shit!
Her name was Fan, and she was hot-tempered.
Old B, if you kick the table one more time, I'm going to stab both your eyes.
Give it to me, Sparrow said. He took the chassis, realigned a crooked filter capacitor, connected it straight to the chassis, soldered it with his hot iron, checked the circuit ground and the alignment, and handed it back. It made him think of an electrified violin.
Comrade Sparrow has the fingers of a little girl,
Thauren joked. Radio Beijing was playing Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto in D major. Ever since the announcement of Mikhail Gorbachev's visit to Beijing in May, they have been bombarded by Tchaikovsky and Alexander Glazunov.
The fact is,
Fan said, pointing her soldering gun at Old B,
these Beijing kids took one look at our lives and decided it wasn't for them. I thought I would study at Fudan University and become a doctor, but look where I am now. Not that you comrades aren't a daily joy to be with. I didn't see my parents or my siblings for 15 years. I know for a fact that Comrade Sparrow here hasn't seen his brothers since they were kids. These days, if you curse the wrong person, you might as well shoot yourself. My sister's kid complained about his corrupt boss. Poor little shit was reprioritized and hasn't been assigned a job for 3 years. He's going to the square every day now.
Sparrow pivoted the chassis and began working at it from the opposite corner.
As the others argued, Tchaikovsky's triplet configurations and double stops rained from the speakers like the beating of 1,000 wings. When at last the shift ended and they all shuffled towards the exit, Sparrow felt as if a century had passed. On the way home, he nearly fell asleep on the crowded tram, pinned between the window and someone's dried beans. His fingers were completely numb. When he finally tumbled out at Beijing West Railway Station, a large crowd was jostling in front of the post office. Lunch tins cracked against his elbows. Sparrow tried to push his way through, but was impeded by the cart of a candy maker. If we let this turmoil go unchecked, a China with a bright future will become a chaotic China with no future. Loudspeakers were broadcasting the 7 o'clock news, which meant he had gotten home later than normal. "These children are creating political turmoil," people around him were muttering. "Counter-revolutionaries? Is that the verdict?" The broadcast continued. "Under no circumstances should the formation of any illegal organizations be allowed." He would have to. Pain sparked along his arms, as if strings had been tied around his fingers and slowly tightened. Wasn't this what Red Guards had done to... He couldn't think. The bystanders around him were staring malevolently at the speakers. "Are they kidding?" someone asked. "Do they plan on using tanks on a bunch of math students?" Uneasy shifting. "This is turmoil. This is like the Cultural Revolution. I've seen more political turmoil in my soup pot." Sparrow pushed his way around the candy man. The vendor tried to interest people in the fantastical shapes he created by pulling sugar syrup. He made words, and even the heads of famous figures. Sparrow had loved these sweets when he was a boy. He bought three, one that seemed to be in the shape of Chairman Mao, another that was clearly Beethoven, and a third unidentifiable. He pushed his way through the crowd. Home at last, he could smell the starchy sweetness of the rice Ai Ming had prepared. His daughter had already laid out pickled turnips and spicy eggplant. On radios and speakers up and down the Hutong, the government verdict on the student demonstrations repeated. "This is a serious political struggle confronting the whole party and people." The announcer let it be known that the editorial would appear in People's Daily the following morning, April 26th, and the party urged all citizens to study it carefully. Sparrow thought he must ask Ai Ming to design a device that surreptitiously turned off other people's radios. A translation of the Collected Letters of Tchaikovsky sat on the television. Why in the world was Ai Ming reading this? He turned its thin pages. He couldn't concentrate on the words, but in the photos, he observed that Tchaikovsky had the large belly of a fortunate man. The composer looked stout and stylish. He turned the pages of the book as loudly as he could, hoping Ai Ming might emerge, missing her company. The letters of Tchaikovsky were full of banter. He seemed to have several brothers. Here Tchaikovsky was writing to one brother about the composition of his famous violin concerto in D major, Opus 35. "It goes without saying that I would have been able to do nothing without him. He plays it marvelously. When he caresses me with his hand, when he lies with his head inclined on my breast, and I run my hand through his hair and secretly kiss it, passion rages within me with such unimaginable strength." Sparrow stared down at the page. Where was the record player? This was a fever pervading his limbs, causing turmoil in his thoughts. He felt such an intense longing for music,
that he was almost a child again, listening to his mother and Swirl as he waited beneath a tea-house table. And where were Kai's letters?